Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to WriteStream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann. And wherever you are in the world, I am thankful and just so happy to have you here with me today for another broadcast. I should introduce myself as sort of the erstwhile host of WriteStream Tuesday. I know I have not been broadcasting every week as I was in the beginning. Life keeps getting in the way. I'm trying to get back on track here. And I have a great guest today, actually a returning guest, Declan Finn, and I see that he is on the line, and I'm just going to ask him just for a few minutes of patience because I want to just do a few housekeeping notes before we get started with today's interview. As many of you know, I am the founder of the WriteStream Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio, and I'm just thrilled to have as hosts on the network the wonderful Lisa Tarvez. Lisa's show is called Just Believe, and it airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio. And it focuses on things like holistic healing, alternative health remedies, spirituality, psychic ability, all sorts of interesting, fascinating topics. Lisa brings on just very intelligent, insightful guests each week. And it's just it's a great show just to kind of expand your awareness, check out something new, call in. Many times her guests, they love to take callers. They'd be willing to talk to you about the topic at hand. And it's just a great show. She's doing an outstanding job with that. And if you've missed any of her shows, of course, you can just go to blogtalkradio.com/WriteStream and listen to the archives. And then my other wonderful host is John D. Gresham. He is a military historian and journalist. And he hosts Military Monday on the WriteStream Radio Network every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And John yesterday was on, known as Doctrine Man. It was a really fun, interesting interview. So if you missed it, again, please go to blogtalkradio.com/stream and check out not just yesterday's podcast, but all of the previous Military Monday episodes. I can't thank John and Lisa enough for all of the hard work they do to, you know, to find these good guests and to schedule them and conduct interesting interviews designed to engage the audience and share information and, you know, of course, welcome calls. So you know, please support their shows by listening to the archive and if you can, listening live, because it's a lot more fun when you can call in during a live show. But along those lines, I am really pleased with Right Stream Radio Network, and I wrote about this on my blog, DariaDiGiovanni.com. It's called the Family Power Hour, and it's going to air every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And it's going to be hosted by two South Florida professional powerhouses, Sheena Benjamin Wise and Dr. Billy Eisenberg. Now, this program is intended to serve as a good starting point for anyone who's seeking advice on how to handle difficult relationships, marriages, divorce, family situations, raising children, pretty much any, if you're having problems with any kind of human interaction, this is the show for you. It's called Family Power Hour. And it's going to feature a very welcoming call-in format, and that's really the goal. We want people to call in and feel comfortable asking questions and receiving advice from Sheena and Dr. Billy. And if you want to be anonymous, that's perfectly okay. If you want to use a different name or just your first name, that's perfectly okay. We understand that. But we want listeners to feel very comfortable calling in and really taking advantage of the knowledge and experience that these two women bring to the table. Sheena Benjamin Wise is a family law attorney practicing in Pompano Beach, Florida, and Dr. Billy Eisenberg is a clinical psychologist and family therapist who works with clients all over the world thanks to things like Skype, which I happen to be broadcasting from right now. Their goal is really to just help people through life's little trials and tribulations. The show is intended to be sort of a starting point, a place to get some advice. In no way is it intended to take the place of legal advice if you need that, but it may give you some insights if you're coping with various situations and you're really looking for some help. So it's called Family Power Hour with Sheena and Dr. Billy, and that is going to start airing on Wednesday night, August 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern, and from there on out, we'll air every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, and tell all your friends about it, listen in, call in, ask questions. These women are just, they're so pumped up and ready to go, and I'm really excited to welcome them to the network. In fact, I'm so excited that I will be interviewing them on Right Stream Tuesday, the day before they go live on the air, and that will be August 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern. So look for that coming up here on Right Stream. Okay, and my guest today is the wonderful Declan Finn, and as some of you may know, I wrote a review a couple of months ago for his awesome book, A Pious Man, A Holy Thriller, which I absolutely loved. And he's going to talk to us hopefully about that today and about his other book called Codename Winterborn. And Declan is, wow, what an imagination this guy has, and just an ability really to pen, just put together intriguing characters and pen interesting plots that keep you guessing the whole time. I certainly was guessing throughout A Pious Man, A Holy Thriller. So we'll talk about John's books and whatever else is on his mind, Declan. Tell you guys, it's been a long, bear with me, I'm dealing with a headache right now, and there's just so many things going on personally, but I'm thrilled to be back on the air. I love Write Stream. I love interviewing authors, and I'm about to bring on the air one of my very favorites, Declan Finn. Declan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Daria. Thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks for joining me. Thanks for bearing with me through my little, you know, my all of my programming notes. I haven't been on the air in a few weeks, so I had a lot to catch up on.
Oh, I run a blog. I know how it feels.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Declan, you know, tell us a little bit. Well, what's going on with you, first of all? Let's kind of break into this here. How have you been doing? How are book sales, marketing? What's going on with you?
Well, book sales have been slower than I have expected, although I think I recently found out why. Now, I don't know if I mentioned this last time, but I am one of the few people left on the planet who doesn't own a Kindle. And
oh, no, I'm right there with you. I don't
know. Well, that's the two of us. And I had been pricing my books for Kindle at $9.99. And then somebody told me, actually last week at the Catholic Writers Guild conference, that, oh, well, the average for a Kindle book is between $2.99 and $4.99. Oops. So I'm quite happy to announce that both of my books have had a price drop recently.
As we've been tweeting that all morning. Well, very good.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I just want to say, I'm with you on the Kindle thing. You know, just wanted to say this briefly. Like 5 years ago when I published my first novel, you know, Kindle was, I think, kind of at the time was just sort of taking off, and it was recommended to me that I make the book available in Kindle, and I said, okay, you know, no problem. I mean, I didn't have a problem doing that because obviously the idea with a book is you want to reach all of your readers, and if your readers are using Kindle, then, you know, it's you're only hurting yourself by not making your book available in that format. But I must say, from a personal standpoint, I want to hold a book in my hands. I want to write in it. I want to highlight it. And maybe it's just all those years of Catholic school and AP English, but that's how I read a book. I pretty much dissect them. And I can't do that on a Kindle. But I certainly understand the appeal. But yes, so don't feel like a Luddite. I read your blog post today. So if you're a Luddite, Declan, then I am too. So let's get to milking some cows or something. I don't know.
Well, considering how New York has been for the last few years, a farm out in, what, Missouri, you would say? Seems like a good idea.
Yeah, poor thing. So, so you've lowered the price on your Kindle. So I guess the idea, I mean, maybe we could talk a little bit about the marketing since you mentioned that. So the idea is, I guess, to make this up on volume with your
book. Heck yeah.
So what are some of the things you do, Declan, to share with us? Because I think too many authors that I talk to just are not, well, and I'm one of my clients, not real keyed into the marketing side of things, but we have to be. So tell us what you do.
I take anything that isn't nailed down, really. I recently went with something called Bostic Communications. We'll reach 10,000 people for you. Whether or not they actually get to 10,000 people is, well, I have no idea since I don't see their mailing list, but they are labeled as some as spammers. It's like, you know what? Even with spam, 1 out of every 100 would usually penetrate, at least as far as junk mail in real mail goes. Sorry, snail mail. so I went that route. It was cheap enough, considering the amount of volume it was sending out. I've got the Twitter account. I've got 2 Facebook pages, one for A Pious Man, APIUSMAN, for anyone who's listening. I have one for A Pious Man. I've got one for Facebook, strike for codename Winterborn. I've got the blog set up for A Pious Man through Blogspot, Blogger, whatever you want to call it. And I've recently discovered Hootsuite, thanks to your recommendation a few months ago. You might have noticed that I'm kind of spamming Twitter.
I hadn't noticed. No, just kidding.
Okay. But,
Hootsuite's great.
Yeah. My general attitude is towards marketing will be the equivalent of jumping up and down, shouting as loud as I can, waving my arms in the air, and hoping somebody notices. Although, recently, I'm doing the free Kindle giveaway. Basically, you can have 5 days out of every 90 if your book is exclusively on Kindle. And what that does, fine, you don't make any money out of it, to be technical. However, say someone downloads your book onto their Kindle. What happens is that your book becomes part of their reading list on Amazon. You know how you go to, pick a random author, John Ringo. You scroll down, and people who have bought this author have also purchased.
Yes.
Now, guess what? They download your Kindle, you get on that list. And there are a lot of people who buy from that list. So,
oh, I see.
That helps,
okay,
too.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Declan, do you blog every day? Because it's funny. Just before I went on the air, I was having a conversation with a very dear friend of mine, and I said to her, you know, one expression I absolutely hate is if you build it, they will come, because it is so not true. And in terms of authors, if you build it, if you write it, they will not come unless you're out there promoting it and engaging your audience on a daily basis. What do you make of that?
Oh, you have to promote it on a daily basis. Otherwise, you're screwed. With my blog, I publish 1 to 3 days a week. I make certain that even if my post is going to be, this is a music piece of music I listen to, and here's the video from YouTube, and have a nice day. In some cases, it's Lindsey Stirling, who's a recent YouTube phenomenon. In some cases, a movie soundtrack, that sort of thing. But one, you got to have content on the blog. Otherwise, you're just going to have people tune in. Oh, look, it's the exact same thing as last week. I'm going to move along now. And it's also a matter of luck. For example, last time you and I had talked, my most viewed blog involved DC Comics and, well, how they had over-sexualized their characters to the point of comedy, because people had been searching for DC Comics and sex. So that was entertaining. However, fast forward several months, and a blog post I posted a year later, which was for my quote-unquote election special. The title was, Who Would Captain America Vote For? And I've looked through my search engine, my statistics, and most viewed search term, Captain America. So it's very hit or miss. At current rate of speed, I'm going to have to find a way to have a blog that encapsulates sex, comic books, and politics. Haven't gotten there yet, but I'm going to have to try. So, like I said, it's a matter of hit or miss and what people are searching for at any given time. And that's not even counting promoting on Twitter, promoting on Facebook. I would say promoting on MySpace, but nobody's promoted on MySpace for years, from what I can tell. Oh, hell, I think I've lost you. Okay, if you can still hear me, I'm going to hang up and redial. Please hold.
Okay, Declan, I apologize for that. Let me bring you back on the air.
Oh, okay, good. I, for a moment, thought it was going to be my end because we've got rain here in New York, and I thought we were cut out.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize. You know, and I have my cell phone nearby, so if it happens again, I may have to call in on that because I'm on Skype. And I happen to be visiting up in Pennsylvania, and we had a horrendous thunderstorm this morning. And I don't know if that's the remnants of that. But anyway, please continue with what you were saying.
Well, here's a question. What was the last thing you heard?
Well, I was talking about blogging. Oh, well, you know, you were talking about having relevant content and the importance of blogging regularly. And it's so important. And one of the things you touched upon, and I wanted to just comment, is that it's not just blogging about your book. Oh, and here's what I wrote. And did you buy my book? And listen, check out this character. It's really about engaging your audience, finding out what they like. And it's kind of like it's an indirect sale, really, an indirect selling process. And the more you can show that you're a well-rounded person, individual, and you can write about a lot of different things and you can promote other authors and connect with your readers on common interests, the more you build those relationships. And, you know, it does lead to book sales, but it's a process.
Oh, absolutely. And it's kind of hard selling your characters and your book if, well, one, nobody's searching for your characters. They don't even know who the bleep you are yet. That's kind of the problem. So that's why you have to blog about almost anything or everything else. And I don't know if you caught this, but at current rate of speed, I'm going to have to come up with a way to develop the perfect blog post. It'll incorporate comic books, sex, and politics. Not entirely certain how to do that just yet, but I'll find a way.
You have the creative mind to do it, Declan. I have faith in you. But, you know, one of the things you also do very well is you create videos. And I think that that's such an important part of your blogging style. And it's very engaging, and people get a chance to not just read what you're posting on your blog, but actually see and listen to you.
Oh, yes. It's on one hand, it's fun for me to do because it's something other than just sitting down. Okay, what am I going to blog about today? Huh. Let me see what, I don't know, Obama's doing to Benghazi, or pick a scandal, any scandal. We've only got about, what was it, 9? I've lost track.
Well, last I heard, yeah. Could be more. I haven't really been keyed in the last couple of days. So, yeah, we could be up to 15 by now.
Yeah. You never thought you'd be nostalgic for Bill Clinton, did you?
Seriously. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess by comparison, yeah, he's looking pretty good, but still not good enough in my mind. But listen, don't get me started on that topic. Look, I want to stick to promoting you and your book. But but you know, now the other thing too, and this kind of ties in with video, Declan. But I watched the trailer several times for Codename Winterborn. I just loved it. Question is, do you make those yourself, or do you hire somebody to do it? And how important are book trailers for success?
Well, I've never been able to exactly measure book trailers to sales. I haven't been able to find a way to link that particular statistic together, although I have noticed that there are a lot of people who plan onto YouTube is like, wow, this was awesome. And to answer your question, no, I don't hire it out, mainly because, well, one, I'm cheap. Two, I'm obsessive compulsive. I have to tinker with everything myself. I did it. I would have done the cover to both Codename Winterborn and A Pious Man. However, the last time I tried doing a book cover, it was for something called It Was Only on Stun. Don't bother looking it up. Just buy the other two books, please. I almost went blind doing that particular cover, and I'm told it was either very good or very awful, depending on who you ask. But in either case, you know what? I don't think I was going to do that. Not again. But no, with the videos, I do it myself. And it's just, for me, I find it's a matter of finding the right music. And after that, everything falls into place. All of the images fall into place. And it just clicks together. Sometimes I will get a narrator because I can only do so many of the funny little voices. And, you know, I'm not Mandy Patinkin. Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. No, I'm not going to try doing that because after a while you just wind up with the Mel Blanc effect where everybody starts to sound the same after a while.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you do an excellent and an outstanding job. And I just think that book trailers, and I know there really isn't, or maybe there is, and I just haven't discovered it, but a way to measure, you know, producing a book trailer versus, you know, book sales. But I just feel like it makes a book so much more compelling. And it's sort of like, you know, if somebody's on the fence maybe about buying a book and they watch a trailer, it can really, if it's done well, it can really capture their interest.
And oh, yeah. So. Well, hey, music videos have been with us from Sesame Street to MTV.
So yeah.
You and I have pretty much grown up with it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when you think of a movie trailer, too, I mean, every movie, there are movie trailers for every movie that's produced. So, And I think particularly with a book to kind of make it come alive for people who maybe are more visual or that they need that sort of enticement. I just think it's a great marketing tool. And if you're not able to create one yourself, I personally think it's worth hiring someone to create one for you because you can really distill your book down. And that's another thing I wanted to talk to you about. Like, you know, I think it's so important for authors to be able, and you're so good at this, to be able to talk about their books, but also very succinctly and kind of be able to distill the basic, you know, the themes and whatever points you're trying to get across so that your audience kind of can get in a nutshell sort of a good flavor of the book without giving away the whole plot. But how important is it to you do you think, for authors to be able to communicate the way you and I are doing now, whether it's on air or whether it's in person at a book club meeting or at any kind of event. How important is that for recognition and ultimately for sales?
I can't emphasize how important it is, considering you're not going to have a lot of time to sell anyone on your book. In fact, even trying to sell them will pretty much turn off a lot of people. For example, I don't go into half of what the opening of A Pious Man is for a simple reason, because if I start, it's going to take 20 minutes just to get through the first 50 pages. However, if I say, oh yeah, it's an anti-Da Vinci Code, I've had a lot of reactions that pretty much go, thank you, God! Which was kind of surprising. Now, granted, a lot of these reactions were last week when I was at the Catholic Writers Guild conference over in New Jersey. God help me, it was in Jersey. But every time I mention, I just say anti-Da Vinci Code. It's like, yes, when's it coming out? It's already out. Okay, great. So,
yeah.
Although that, well, the entire, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and that's also an example of knowing your audience, Declan, when you say
Yeah.
You kind of go where your audience is, it sounds like.
Oh, definitely. You got to know who your audience is. Although in the case of A Pious Man, I kind of cheated. If you look at the write-up on Amazon, it looks like a standard Da Vinci Code cut and paste. You know, we've got, what, about 6 Da Vinci Code ripoffs every 5 minutes nowadays? Evil Catholic Church, evil Nazi church, papists, blah, blah, blah. If I see one more evil Catholic Nazi priest, I'm going to bang my head against the wall. In fact, I've got this nice little spot picked out on the wall. It already starting to look like the dent in my head would make. So,
yeah.
So there's that, and with Codename Winterborn, for example, I have not been trying to sell it a lot as conservative, which it turned out to be, well, one, I think it's actually more libertarian than anything else, which is strange because my general attitude towards politics is, please leave me alone. For example, when the gay marriage thing in New York came up, it's, okay, you're going to marry gay and lesbian couples. Are you going to be putting a gun to the head of the Catholic Church? No. Any other churches? No. It's good. The moment you do that, we're going to have problems.
Right, exactly. Well, let me just interject on that, though. My only issue with that is I just object to the agenda, and I object to the fact that when the vote goes a different way in a particular state, like when the vote went that way in New York, you didn't see any conservatives rioting or burning down people's churches or getting people fired. But that certainly did happen in California several years ago when people voted for traditional marriage. And anyone found to have given money to a traditional marriage cause lost their job. Not everybody, but I mean, there were people that were targeted. There were churches that were vandalized. There's that inconsistency there with conservatives, and I'll throw libertarians in there too, who probably most of them don't care, one way or another. But I will say with conservatives, even if you're living in New York and you're a conservative and you have a personal objection, you look at it as, well, okay, this is what was voted on. These are representatives elected by the people. This is how they voted on this issue. Fine. And as you say, let's uphold religious freedom at the same time. But what I object to is the fact that respect is not afforded on the other side when the vote goes a different way.
Well, it's not even a matter, I think, of politics. It is to a great extent. However, I'll give you a for instance, something that I only learned about maybe 20 minutes before your show started. You've heard of Richard Dawkins, right?
Yes.
Militant atheist, Catholics are stupid. If you're a Christian, you're stupid. Hasn't said anything about Orthodox Jews that I know of. Anyway,
right.
He apparently tweeted, a whole 140 characters saying something that was slightly critical of Islam. I don't know the exact text off the top of my head. There are already people in Britain, where he lives and works, who are calling for his being fired. Gee, going after Christians, Catholics, etc., for decades doesn't merit even a whisper, but one tweet is,
yeah,
kill him. Yeah, no. So, like I said, it depends not only on politics, but on who you go after. I believe it was G.K. Chesterton once said, any stigma will do to beat a dogma. Well, now we know which dogma.
Right. Well, can anyone say dimitude? Yeah, it's really very distressing what's going on in Europe and over there. I mean, this is a country who just saw one of their soldiers brutally beheaded in the middle of the street. And their immediate reaction was, oh, now, you know, we're worried about anti-Islam bias. I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. And, you know, we have a certain amount of that, unfortunately, here in the States, too. I really don't know what it's going to take to get people to wake up to the threat of Sharia law and especially being a woman. I mean, I think about how women are treated, you know, the genital mutilations, the honor killings. You know, if you come forth and let the police know that you've been raped, you're punished, you're beaten up, you're thrown in prison, you're probably beheaded or stoned to death. I mean, and it's just absurd. And you know, I think there's a certain safety net that people like Richard Dawkins are aware of when it comes to Christians and even Jews. I mean, you can pick on us all day long and maybe somebody will criticize you back, or they might say, well, I'll pray for your soul since you don't believe in God, or, you know, I don't like what you said. You know, maybe they might hurl an insult back, maybe.
But we're not going to cut his head off.
Exactly. We're not going to issue an intifada and say, kill all those who insult Christianity or behead those who insult Catholicism. It's just not how we roll, and they know that.
Well, hey, did you – I don't know. I know I sent you a copy of Codename Winterborn. Have you started it yet?
I have, Declan, but I have to be honest with you. I've had so many things going on. I haven't had a chance really to get into it, but I'm looking forward to it.
The only reason I mention it is, it's set in the year 2093, science fiction, and a mission into the Islamic Republic of France.
Mm.
There was a reason I did that, if only for demographics.
Yeah. Well, they're losing their culture. I mean, and they're being out reproduced. What is it, by like 3-1? Maybe it's even worse than that. You might probably know better than I.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. I'm told the birth rate has balanced out in recent years, but if you tell, I'll believe that when it lasts long enough to balance out for all the years that they weren't equal birth rate.
Yeah. Now, and Mark Stein is sort of the authority on demographics. I know he's written extensively about that over the years, and his book, I think it's America Alone. I can't remember which one, but, you know, and certainly in his commentary and his articles, he talks about that a lot. And I know as recently as a couple of years ago, like in Italy, for example, I think they were actually a negative birth rate there, and it might have been the same for France. So it's very appropriate that you set your book in the Islamic Republic of France, because they're just, it seems like all over Europe, they're just rolling over and playing dead and ceding their culture. It's very frightening.
Yeah, pretty much. Hey, you got to consider, though, at least with Britain. Now, the British media are a bunch of, well, they're the same stalwart individuals we have in our news media. So that tells you that. But their politicians seem to be acknowledging that, yes, we do have a problem, and voting seems to be swinging back the other direction, away from all the good, kind-hearted, pure, lily-livered liberals that they currently have. So with any luck, Britain will be the salvation of Europe, which, as mostly an Irish-American Catholic, pains me to say, but they are good for something.
Sure. Right. Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, exactly. I mean, it's very scary to look over there and just see how, and I hope that you're right, and I hope that maybe at least the British politicians are waking up, but it's just sad and scary to see Europe just so willing to just roll over and die and just cede their culture, and this is... You know, it's no accident that there's all this immigration, you know, from Muslim countries into European countries. I mean, their ultimate goal is the caliphate, you know, and they're, you know, what's so frustrating is they're very clear about it. And before anybody says, oh, you're painting all people with the same brush, I'm not talking about like normal, you know, actually I feel for Muslim women. I mean, some peaceful Muslims who are just living their lives are as much at risk as anybody. But unfortunately, the ones who are causing the problems are causing them, you know, are causing big time problems. And that is their goal. And it's just very sad to see Europe, you know, just ceding their culture. Like I said, yeah, they're just rolling over.
Well, in the case of France, at least, they've been killing their culture since 1792. Are we really surprised that this is the end result? Nice little revolution, nice great big guillotine, that sort of thing. But,
yeah, you know, unfortunately, they descended into mob rule instead of the rule of law, which we had here, thank God. And, and you had your reign of terror and Robespierre, and that was pretty much the end of that.
Yes. I would actually recommend to you at some point a science fiction series written by a man named David Weber. He calls it the Honor Harrington series. It's basically Horatio Hornblower with a female captain in space, and one of the primary antagonists is a Robert S. Pierre. He's very subtle.
Very clever. And, very clever.
Yeah. Yeah. But and of course everyone calls him Rob. But welcome to my inspiration for Winterbourne.
Well, so tell us about a little bit about Winterbourne. Now, Declan, this was in collaboration with another author, correct?
Yes, my friend Alan Yaskowitz.
Okay. And so what was that process like? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, to start with, he had come up with a general idea for a quote-unquote, post-apocalyptic universe, at which point I almost tore his head off, because there is no post after the apocalypse. You know, you see the apocalypse, skies turn cold, sun turns black, then it's over. You know, it only gets worse from there. So I told him, okay, fine. You're going to have a nice little nuclear war in 2090. What's the rest of your world like? So it wound up being developed from there. He wanted to have a standard dystopia set in San Francisco. You know, dystopia, for those of you who don't or are not familiar with the term, that would be like Escape from New York or Detroit, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
or Agenda 21 by Harriet Park. That's a dystopia also.
Thank you. Harriet Park, George Orwell.
Yeah.
Etc. So I wound up suggesting, well, you have a perfect little place to dump the people who are completely and utterly inconvenient. So why not have a former spy? I had grown up on The Prisoner with Patrick McGoohan, so this was something I was familiar with. And I wrote a 12-page treatise, and Alan said, this is brilliant. You want to be my co-author? And things kind of spiraled out of control from there. You know, originally, Codename Winterbourne was not book one. We had written book one, set entirely in a dystopia of San Francisco, and I had given my main character a one-line backstory that was, he enforced his own version of term limits after politicians had blown the cover on his team. Period, end sentence, move along. I figured, you know what, maybe I should write a little something about how that happened. Then I started what became Codename Winterbourne. It spiraled out of control and then ate book one.
So does that mean it's incorporated? Book one is incorporated into Codename Winterbourne?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Let's just say the last 50 pages are what's left of book one.
So was that the first time you actually collaborated with another author on a book?
Oh, yes. I think I had been doing – no. Actually, no. I have a friend who does some fan fiction, and I help him with that because – he wanted to do fan fiction for 24 and didn't know how to do fight scenes. But no, even then came after Codename Winterborn and the entire Last Survivors series, as my friend Alan likes to call it. But yeah, this is the first time I collaborated. Some of it was very easy because we could just sit down. It's like, okay, I write one line, he writes another line, and the keyboard would go back and forth half the time. And sometimes it was just a matter of, I make a suggestion 1 week, 3 weeks later, he gives me the suggestion back. It's like, huh, this feels like a Dilbert comic routine. But when I had interviewed once with the Open Sources Media Center. They used to be a division of the CIA. And I told him about how I worked with groups, and I told him that particular anecdote, and he said, oh, yes, well, if you're doing it deliberately, that's what we call managing up. All I could think was, wow, what kind of managers do you have?
So, you know, did you ever at any point, because I know I'm ghostwriting, I'm almost done ghostwriting this fantasy kind of sort of novel that I'm working on for a client, and it's been fun, and we've had, you know, he's a good friend of mine, so we've had our creative differences. I mean, we've had some very passionate discussions, but, you know, we've always been able to work it out and stay on track, and sometimes I compromise on something, and sometimes he will. But did you find that, you know, did that happen often in the course of writing Winterborn?
In terms of compromises?
Yeah, and in terms of maybe creative differences, and maybe you felt like the plot should go one way or a character should do something this way, and your co-author had a completely opposite idea. I mean, how did you kind of work that out?
Believe it or not, there were no problems like that. There were some issues in terms of character development, but he had his set of characters that he wanted a certain way, and it's like, okay, fine. You go play with your toys, I'll go play with mine, and we'll see how they interact. And that worked to a great extent. We've had a few character issues, but we pounded those out, ironed them over, and they seem to be going smoothly right now. We're currently working on book two.
Wonderful.
So we're about halfway through that.
Excellent. Now, do you have a release date in mind for it?
For book two of Codename Winterborn? No,
yeah.
Not yet. Not yet. I've got a release date, I hope, for my book, A Pious Legacy. Yes, there is a sequel, which should be sometime between... I'm shooting for December, which probably means it'll come out in time for Easter. But I'm hoping for December.
Well, Declan, you are a prolific author. I am just, like, amazed at how many books you're able to crank out in a short period of time.
Well, it comes from a habit of years of writing, rewriting. I'm going to go to college now, come back. Wow, this is awful. Keep rewriting. And after about 10, 15 years of that, you wind up with 15 to 20 novels.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That's good. And, you know, I know myself, like, I find ghostwriting has a whole different, as challenging as it is to write your own book, and I think I would have it would be challenging for me to collaborate on a book as you have successfully done. But ghostwriting is just a whole different animal because for me, it's like I felt such a strong sense of responsibility, particularly that this client is, English is his second language, which is obvious, big part of the reason why I'm writing the book for him. But, you know, I feel such a responsibility to really bring his concept to life and really just, you know, give it my best. I mean, I think I feel more responsible for his than I did when I was writing mine. And it took me, I mean, we have a publisher and Freedom Forge actually is interested in taking a look at it. And I finally, I mean, I drove my, and I want to ask you about this. I mean, I drove myself crazy editing and re-editing the working manuscript. And I finally said, you know what? I just finally had to tell myself, all right, just submit it because they're only going to make edits anyway, you know, so just
exactly.
Like get over yourself and just send it in. So I got it, you know, in as good a shape as I possibly could. And I said, you know what, I'm sending it off. So what are your thoughts about that whole process?
Of editing?
Yeah. You know.
Well, since I'm self-publishing for the most part, I have to make certain that it's perfectly polished, otherwise people are going to rip me apart. There have been some people who have done that for a pious man, which it's like, wait, you want to mention a line or two that wasn't edited well, please, at all? So far, I've had no problems with that with Codename Winterborn. As you noted, it's currently got a 5-star review on Amazon. I'm still trying to figure out how that happened, you know. Well, I don't know any of you, and I didn't even have to pay for it. So it helps to have a lot of beta readers who are mostly English majors and a lot of people who have no time on their hands.
Yeah.
In my case, I have to make it perfect. Otherwise, there is no professional editor waiting for me at the end of the day. Unless I'm going to go out and pay one, which I'm told the rates on those can vary northwards of $2,000. It's like,
yeah.
If I had $2,000 to burn, I'm not sure I'd be going this route. Thank you.
Well, that is so true. And I have to say, with Water Signs, my first book, I mean, I was like you. I edited and re-edited, and I had like a group of readers that were that actually read it chapter by chapter as I was writing. It was a very interesting process. But I completely understand your point, because as independent authors, as I like to call it, versus self-published authors, there's so much, the bar is set so much higher for us, because even in the age of new media, there's still a stigma, if I may use that word, with being a self-published author. So people are looking to nitpick on anything. And I have to say, I don't know who was nitpicking on A Pious Man, a holy thriller, because that book was absolutely amazing, very well written. I didn't see any mistakes or any problems with grammar, Declan. So sometimes I think that there are people, I think it's human nature, that when people see someone else going after their dream and accomplishing something, it's as if it's sort of they take it as a personal insult to them, because maybe they don't have the courage to go for it. So therefore, they find things to criticize, whether they're valid or not. I mean, there certainly is such a thing as constructive criticism, but what you're describing to me just sounds like pettiness.
Well, in some cases, although I've had one person who said it needed line editing, who I ran into at the Catholic Writers Conference. She came up to me, it's like, hi, do I know you? It's like, well, I've written this book, Pious Man, a Holy Thriller. It's like, oh, it's you. It's an honor to meet you. She grabbed my hand and started shaking it and was talking to me for the next 5 minutes about how wonderful the book was. It's like, wait, I'm still back at you're honored to meet me? Like, wait, what? But then again, she also later pointed out that people pay more attention to 3-star reviews than even 5-star reviews. And she had started her 5-paragraph long review with, I loved this book. It was a great book. It's like, okay. Then you gave it 3 stars. I'm going to just smile, nod, and stick with, wait, you're honored to meet me? I'm still confused.
Wait, I'm not sure that I understand that logic. So
I'm not entirely certain either.
Okay. Because last I checked, 5-star was like the holy grail that everybody was striving for.
As did I, but apparently there is a strain of thought that goes, people ignore 5-star reviews and go to 3-star, which I don't know about you, but I've never bothered looking at a 3-star. I've looked at the highest stars, I've looked at the lowest stars, and not too much in the middle, because I want to see if you're going to be ripping somebody apart, and I want to try reading this book, I want to see if there are actual plot holes in it. And I've seen some that I've been turned off by, and I've seen some reviews that said, you know what, just because you hate this book, I'm going to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the review is thorough and they make some valid criticisms of the book, you know, maybe the plot was incomplete, the characters weren't fully developed, and they can actually give concrete examples, and that shows that the person actually read the book, then you can take that critique seriously. But if they're just out to criticize and nitpick, I think it's pretty evident. I can tell when I read a review whether the person's read the book or not.
Well, I have yet to pick up on that particular talent.
Well, I strive, like, as a book reviewer, and without being a spoiler, I try to at least write the review in such a way that people will know, okay, yeah, she actually read the book. You know, by just maybe you refer to a particular character or a couple of things, pull some different quotes or a certain plot point, something. I think you have to show, I mean, at least me as I'm writing a review, I think out of respect to the author, you really should kind of write your review that way so that at least they can understand that they see that you read it, whichever way the review goes.
True. Although the quote I've noticed that a lot of people tend to cite from a pious man is, "Sean, what are you doing with that fuel truck?" And if your audience doesn't get the joke, they really should read the book.
Yeah, well, from my standpoint, a pious man, what I liked was that you really sort of cleared up some misconceptions about history. And I had never heard of that play that you what's the name of the play that really started that whole fallacy about the Nazis?
The Deputy by Ralph Hawkuth.
Yes. I had never, until I read your book, believe it or not, I had never heard of that play and didn't really understand, although I had seen people repeat that over and over again on Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, particularly when the Pope resigned and then the new Pope came in, and, you know, there was all a lot of anti-Catholic things going on. And I just didn't understand where that whole Nazi thing came from until you told me about the Deputy. So the book was very educational for me, too, from a historical standpoint.
Well, I do try. Hey, all that graduate work in history had better work accounted for something.
So now, Declan, are you a full-time writer? Is this, you know, how you are able to make your full-time living?
Yep. As a New York resident, I'm pretty much stuck with the options that I don't have. As I mentioned, I was a history major. That was before I realized that, oh, wait, the history market? If you went to modern European history, you're unemployable because, like Thomas Jefferson said about the Supreme Court, few die and none resign. Welcome to most modern history faculties at universities nowadays. So I discovered, okay, I went for a completely useless degree. Well, useless from a economic standpoint. And instead of joining the Occupy Wall Street crowd, because I like bat showers, personally.
I'm very happy to hear that.
Yeah. So instead of joining them, it's, okay, I'm going to start writing, and I'm going to pedal as fast as I can. Oh, Mayor Bloomberg, you've increased jobs 250% in New York City under your watch. That's nice. And how many of those people are being filled? How many of those jobs are being filled by three people? Sorry, it's a point of propaganda that Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been pushing lately about the jobs boom in New York. All I could think was, wait, Anthony Weiner was going to leave New York one way or the other because his entire district had been wiped out of existence because we've lost 2 or 3 million people from New York City, and somehow we're adding jobs. How do you work that Hollywood math exactly? So, sorry,
yeah, fuzzy,
I'm cynical.
Fuzzy, it's fuzzy math, I think. Yeah, well, hey, at least you got your big gulps back, right? So there's always that.
Yep, and the cops have stopped, and the cops are no longer allowed to stop and frisk. So that should be interesting.
Honestly, I don't know. Well, first of all, I commend you for being able for making a go of it as a writer full time, especially in a place as expensive as New York. I honestly don't know how people do it, even if they are employed full time. So expensive there.
Mm. Oh, yes, and it's not getting any cheaper. I believe one of your other fellow blog talk, or at least We Built That Radio, Robert, can't remember his last name off the top of my head. I'll
Bertrand,
probably remember.
Robert Bertrand, yeah. He's doing an awesome job.
As he told me, leave New York, go to Ohio, go to Florida, go to some place that is a swing state. Like, yeah, sure, as soon as I can afford to move.
Yeah, easier said than done, right?
Oh, yeah.
I understand that. But seriously, I mean, it's a great accomplishment to be able to take care of yourself writing full-time. And I think with new technology, and you're certainly using it to your advantage. I mean, you know, I think that it's a shame that so many, I just run into authors who just, you know, not that long ago I interviewed, and I can't even remember who it was, and she's successful. She's traditionally published, so maybe she doesn't need social media, but she sort of poo-pooed the whole idea of Twitter and Facebook, and I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, like Twitter's where I met Robert, for just as an example, who introduced, and then he introduced me to a whole world, a whole community of, you know, the config writers, and I've connected with Writer Wednesday, and there's so many writing groups on there, and I think to myself, well, okay, I mean, and who am I to argue with her success? I'm not here to, you know, to argue, to detract from someone or to you know, be a contrarian, but I, particularly, but, you know, for those of us who are independently published, who have put our work out there, if you're not taking advantage of social media, which is pretty much either low, you know, very little cost or no cost in many cases. I mean, you can get a free platform on WordPress or Blogger, Typepad, and start your blog. Then I just think you're missing out. I mean, you know, and even in the age now where people are traditionally published, the money's just not there for the marketing budget. I mean, a lot of these authors still have to take on the bulk of the marketing themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And there is another factor, because writing is such a solitary profession, and unless you have a co-author, and in some cases, it might be better to have your co-author a little farther away. Jim Bayon of Bayon Books used to have a law about co-authors, that they have to live about 6 hours apart by car, because 6 hours was just enough time to load up the guns in the truck and start moving out and then think better of it. But unless you're working with a co-author and you're violating Jim Bayon's rule of co-authors, it's such a solitary profession. Without the internet, without media, but without social media, I probably would have never gone to the Catholic Writers Conference last week. I can't imagine being in contact with half the people I am, you for one, Robert for another, and I would probably be in my own self-imposed solitary confinement, because I just plug myself into the computer, I sit down, I start writing, and I hope to God I don't go crazy from lack of sleep.
Yeah, no, that's such a great point. It is. It's a social outlet. It's a network, a way to network and meet other people and bounce off ideas and really have social interaction. Because you're right, writing is a solitary activity. And even when you're collaborating with somebody, it's still, you know, you're sitting at your computer and you're just writing all day. And, you know, you need that interaction. I mean, I know there's sort of this, and I've met many writers who are reclusive, but for those of us who do have a personality like you and I and do like interacting with people, social media is a godsend. It truly is.
Oh, yes. Well, it helps. Well, it helps if you have the right people. I like being sociable with you. I like being sociable with certain individuals. And then there's the rest of humanity. But, again, this might just be because I'm stuck in New York. It's like, yes, well, I'm a conservative Catholic. You're what? I'm going to be over here now. You had better leave. It's like, seriously, people?
Yeah, but, no, that I can understand. And, you know, Declan, I have to say this, too. You are so not New York, in my experience. Most people I know from New York are very pushy and in your face, and they have obnoxious accents, and you don't fit any of that criteria. So, I don't know. What happened to you?
Well, I grew up with parents who liked to speak English. I grew up being educated a lot in my household, because even my local Catholic school was a little bit wary on Catholic doctrine. And you're not the first person who has told me that. I've gone to restaurants in New York, around Queens, even in Manhattan from time to time. And the waitress, waiter, whoever, has said, oh, are you from out of town? No, I grew up in Queens my entire life. Thank you. Hi, this is my father. He was born at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, back when we had a Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Well,
and stuff like that. But again, I grew up with parents who like speaking English.
Well, you are very, very lucky indeed. It's just funny. I had a conversation with a good friend of mine about, I don't even know how it came up, but we were talking about it and just how, just generally speaking, and I'm sorry, I hope I'm probably offending a lot of people who are listening right now, but, you know, I always said growing up too, you know, people, they love to make fun of Southern accents. I always say, give me a Southern, I love Southern accents. I'm like, give me that any day over a New York accent or a Boston accent. And just the whole superiority attitude, you know, living, I've lived in South Florida, what, for like 19 years. And unfortunately, there's a huge New York influence there, a lot of relocated people. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, if I'm standing in line, like, for whatever, at a restaurant or whatever it is, and there's people in line from New York, they're always complaining about, well, in New York, it's not like this. In New York, this is so much better. And I sit there and I think to myself, well, do us all a favor and move back there then if it's so much better. But they have this attitude, and you're excluded, but I mean, generally speaking, I mean, most New Yorkers I bump into have that attitude of superiority, and I can't stand it, and let alone the obnoxious accent. So kudos to you and your parents, Declan, I have to say.
Thank you.
So, now that I've just alienated much of my audience, but, you know, hey. You know, I've met wonderful people from New York, too, but it's the in-your-face, the constant, the boorishness, I guess, that just starts to wear on me after a while.
Well, in some cases, boorishness does have its advantages, especially after an hour and a half on the subway, where you're trapped with a whole bunch of other people who are tired. They haven't had their morning coffee yet, and they're stuck so close to the person next to them that any closer they would need a condom. So, yeah, that kind of closeness and, hi, we're living on top of each other, does not breed a pleasant, polite atmosphere. One of the nice things, one of the reasons I can see for disallowing guns in New York, after all, we have not become Chicago yet, is we're so tightly packed, you shoot somebody and you miss, you're going to hit somebody else.
Yeah.
And God help you, if you have a 45, it'll just punch right through the person you're aiming at and go through into someone who is just passing by.
Yeah, that's a good point. I never thought of it that way before.
Yes, at which point, whenever somebody tells me that, my first response is, that's what hollow points are for. And aim.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, go ahead.
You know, Brad, this is from somebody who has, again, grown up my entire life in New York. I've never even held a gun, which is kind of awkward considering how many shootouts I have.
Well, you must have a very good imagination then, Declan.
Research helps.
Well, yeah. Tell me about research. Oh, my gosh. I can't tell you how many hours of research I put into this book that I'm writing for my client. And very, very, very interesting, you know, a lot of historical references and things. But, yeah, I mean, that's another really hugely important piece to writing. I think that sometimes we tend to overlook that. Or, you know, people, I guess your average reader doesn't really read a book and necessarily think about all the time the author has had to put into research. But how many, like, on average with your books would you say, I mean, have you broken it out, how many hours it usually takes you to research?
Unfortunately not, because, well, in the case of both Codename Winterborn and A Pious Man, a lot of the research that went into it came from something else. With a lot of the science, it's stuff I've picked up here and there. I believe I picked up something in Codename Winterborn. It's called liquid body armor. I think it was an offhand mention in a James Rollins novel I read once, and then I started to research it on the you know, the wonderful world of Google, and that wasn't even doing research for a book per se. It was just, I thought it was cool. And, you know, it's not like I come in with a stopwatch to do all the research, because I'm one of those people who's an information sponge. I like trivia. However, whenever I start writing a book, all the trivia comes out. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just 'cause who you are and what you're doing, you know, the things that you're reading and looking up on a daily basis.
Oh, yes. Not to mention, my mind has become wired so that I am the perfect writer. I visit someplace and I figure out the best way to blow it up. I went to a restaurant in Chicago called the Signature Room in the Hancock Building. If no one knows it, that's because it's not the Sears Tower. But it's a nice, tall, I think it's a skyscraper, even by New York standards. And they had a beautiful restaurant called the Signature Room, and I wasn't particularly planning to put it into another novel, but I wound up having a nice little fight scene there, too. Although one novel was so bad like that that my family, when they read it, said, this book is all about the tourist guide to having fight scenes while you eat. Like, okay, well, I didn't plan it that way, honest. But it was kind of like a Dirty Harry movie, you know. Every time Clint Eastwood went out to eat, somebody would start robbing a bank.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I didn't plan it, but that's what happened.
Too funny. Let me ask you something on a personal level, because I asked you about, you know, are you writing full-time? Do you ever deal with, have you ever had to deal with people who say, well, why don't you go get a real job, or, you know, writing, or they think that, you know, being a freelance writer is a joke. It just means that you're a grifter. Do you ever deal with, like, negativity in that sense from anyone? And if so, how do you handle it?
Well, I haven't really come across that all that often. Although, my first thought upon hearing get a real job, my automatic sarcastic New York side says, oh, you mean I should move into Zuccotti Park, or have they now tried to take over the Trinity Churchyard?
Mm.
You know, maybe I can become a professional protester. Gee, didn't they do that with, didn't they try to do that to Scott Walker?
Yes,
a few years
absolutely
back?
They did. Yes, they did. They were paid, a lot of them.
So, oops, sorry, I can come up with better uses of my time than sitting out trying to protest somebody who I actually agree with. So, thanks, have a nice life. So, and considering considering how many people work on the government payroll nowadays, what, 50% of the population? It's like, gee, you want to get a real job? Let's talk, shall we?
Exactly. No, I was just curious. I've certainly dealt with it, unfortunately, from certain family members and other people, you know. And there's a lot of people out there that just do not understand social media at all. They think it's a joke, but yet they have no problem proclaiming judgment on those of us who do utilize it for professional reasons.
Hey, Daria, we're writers. This is first time somebody mouths off and says, why can't you get a real job? You smile, you nod, and you plot how you're going to kill him in your next book.
That's right. There you go.
You know, or as they said over at the Catholic Writers Guild, Catholic writers will put you into a state of mortal sin, then kill you in a book.
There you go. That's the ticket. So, yeah. Absolutely. We are right. And, you know, that brings up another point that I'm so happy to have met, you know, people like you and Robert and everyone I've met on Twitter and all the writers, different writers communities, even on LinkedIn. There are several writers groups that I'm involved with. And people are very supportive. And I think that's so important. Too many times, I think some writers think of other writers as competition. And I think there's an endless supply of readers out there. And not every reader likes every genre. So the possibilities are endless for everybody, and the best thing we can do is support each other.
Oh, absolutely. Although I have been told, this is a little tidbit of information I picked up last week that your listeners might be interested in, excuse me, that if you go into the business of writing and independent publishing, see if you can avoid using the romance genre label for your books. Apparently, there are about 4 million books published on Kindle. 3 million of them are romance novels.
Really?
It's apparently less fighting it's less fighting if you go into a different genre, or at least label it a different genre. Although I gotta tell you, I keep writing books. A pious man, a holy thriller, it's an action story. How did this love subplot get in there? Where did this romance come in? I did the same with Codename Winterborn, and again, wait, why is there a romance subplot here? Maybe I'm just a romantic sap to start with.
Yeah, no, I think it's good to add a little those elements to a book, though. But, you know, I have to speaking of romance category, I'll tell you a funny story about, gosh, this must have been like 1995 or 96 when the internet was still in its very early stages. And I was living in Boca, Florida, Boca Raton, Florida, and I was friends with a woman who was a romance author. And they were such nice people, her and her husband. And so she invited me to go to I think it was Romance Writers of America chapter meeting. And it was down in, I believe, Hollywood, Florida, near Fort Lauderdale. So we went, and I sat there, and I listened to all these different writers talking about the formula, and if you want to have explicit sex scenes, then this is the publisher you use, and here's how many sex scenes you should have. And I was so appalled listening to it. Not that I'm a prude. Not because I'm a prude. I'm sitting there thinking, where is the creativity? You're talking about a book like it's, I don't know. I felt like I was sitting at a board meeting and we're talking about, I don't know. I don't even know how to explain it, but I was just sitting there going, they were just fitting their writing into a specific formula based on what a particular publisher wanted. I had no idea that there were degrees like with romance novels in terms of the sexual explicitness of the books. So if you were going to just be, if it was just sort of mildly sexual, I guess, for lack of a better way to describe it, then this is the publisher for you, and then you have to have X amount of sex scenes. But if you want to be really explicit and graphic, then this publisher, this is what they're looking for. And I don't know, I was just so turned off by the whole thing, and I thought, are you kidding me? Like, it's almost like those books are just written, there's a marginal plot there in between the sex scenes, and that's, you know, and that's about it. And there's zero creativity involved.
Daria? I hate to break this to you, but I got four words. 50 Shades of Grey.
Which I haven't read, by the way.
I don't know anyone who has read it, but it's like, wait, why are all these people reading this book? And second, they're making a movie? Isn't this called porn?
Yeah, like, well, no, that's the state of our culture today, unfortunately. And I'm not saying that depending on the plot and your story and what's happening, that a well-placed love scene, although it was, I prefer to write tasteful scenes, isn't called for, but this was just, this was just way too much for me. And I left that meeting thinking, you know, and at that time I hadn't, you know, I was writing feature articles for a local paper, and I was just kind of starting out, and I thought, this is not for me. I'm never going to be a romance novelist, because if I have to fit myself into one of those molds, it's just not going to happen. I reject that. So, yeah, it's amazing. Now, that book, the popularity of that book, it's really, I think it's a sad commentary on our culture. Like I said, I haven't read the book and I don't plan to read it, but it is. It's pornography from what I've heard, yeah. You know. And
yeah, well, I actually kind of took that on more, well, went after it just a little bit because I have been, one of the things my co-author commented on, although I've noticed nobody else had, was that, John, you know, Declan, how did you do a PG-rated sex scene? It's like, pause. Wait, did I put a sex scene in that book? Yeah, I guess, kind of. It's like, and I had so underplayed it that I had forgotten it was even there. And, you know, technically a sex scene, but apparently it worked. I was shooting for, as you said, a love scene. This is about romance. This is not about fornication, blast it.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
And there is something to be said for leaving some things to the reader's imagination. But unfortunately, we're living in a culture where everything is just out there, whether it's on the internet, in the movies, in television.
It's called they don't have an imagination.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And everybody's into pushing the envelope, and we don't seem to have any boundaries anymore. You know, we used to live in a culture where personal matters were just that personal, and personal family issues or whatever it was were taking care of among the family. Now we have people, I call it the Jerry Springerization of our culture. They're out there on television, you know, for money, and, you know, just we're celebrating the worst of human behavior, I guess. And people are making money from it, and it's just very, very depressing to me.
I felt that way about soap operas. Now I'm starting to think that soap operas are considered high art.
Yeah, compared to that, yeah. Amazing. But, Declan, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of let everybody know where they can find you and your books and purchase them and check out your blog and all that good stuff.
Okay. Well, you can find my book on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. You put in a .com, you can probably find Codename Winterborn or Pious Man. Again, Pious in this case is spelled P-I-U-S after the Pope. I've got the Twitter account that is A Pious Man Novel, also spelled the same pious way. Facebook, or Facebook is, you put in the search term for Codename Winterborn or A Pious Man, you'll trip over me in short order. The blog is apiousman.blogspot.com. We don't have one for Codename Winterborn just yet. We've been a little busy. And to contact at least me directly is DeclanFinnInc@AOL.com. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. And short of giving my LinkedIn profile, I can't imagine it.
And well, Declan, also, let me just ask you, do you offer services, ghostwriting services, editing services for others who might be interested in that?
Well, I don't make a point of advertising it, but if somebody wanted to come up to me and say, hi, would you like to write my book for me? It's like, okay, how much are you paying me? I'm not going to say no to getting money. Like, I don't know.
Nor am I. Okay.
Yes, I believe it was Samuel Johnson who once said, only a blockhead doesn't write for money. I could be mistaken.
Right. Well, hey, that's why Charles Dickens' novels are so long, right? He was writing for money.
he was being paid by the word.
Yeah, let's figure out a way. Let's get back to that, because I can be pretty wordy. Well, Declan, I want to thank you for joining me today. You were my only guest today, which was awesome, so we got to spend some time. And again, I encourage everybody to follow you at A Pious Man Novel on Twitter, P-I-U-S. Find him on Facebook. It's A Pious Man Novel on Facebook as well. And then your second page is Codename Winterborn. So
yep.
Check him out, follow him, and definitely check out the blog, A Pious Man. Piousman.blogspot.com, correct? Let me just repeat that.
Yep.
And wonderful. And definitely I'm encouraging everyone to check out your book trailers and the videos that you make, because I just think that's so important. A lot of people are very visual, and it gives them sort of more of a personal connection with you as the author, which I found in my experience people were just as interested in the author as they are in the book you've written. So I think the videos are helpful.
Oh, yes. In which case, I also recommend doing vlogs.
Yes. Okay, very quickly, tell us what a vlog is before we sign off for anybody who may not know.
Vlog, a video log as opposed to a blog, which is a web log. And you can basically sit down, start talking at your web camera, and then upload it to YouTube, which is what I do, only in a hopefully more organized format. Lately, I've been discussing a lot of the things you and I have been talking about, etc. So, and what to do with when self-publishing your book.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to check those out. Absolutely. It's very helpful. And you know, another point I guess I'll make really quickly here at the end is, you know, sharing a little bit of information that's useful for other people goes a long way to building those relationships. So just as you were talking about, you know, how to find the best self-publisher for you, sharing the information like that that's so valuable is going to help, you know, build your audience and your following. So I commend you for that.
Thank you.
So. Well, everybody, well, Declan, any parting thoughts before we sign off?
Here's a parting thought. Both A Pious Man and Codename Winterborn are free this Labor Day on Kindle. So go out, have a free book on me.
Awesome. And let me tell you something, you'll enjoy every moment of it. I only just started Codename Winterborn, but it's a great book. So I will be posting a review in the next couple of weeks, Declan, as soon as I'm so far behind on book reviews, but I promise you're in the lineup. So
hey, no rush. Just enjoy it. And if you want me to come back and talk about it some more after you've read it, I'll be happy to do that too.
I would love to. All right, everyone. Well, this is Declan. Thank you so much for joining me. Everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for RightStream Tuesday. Declan will definitely be back. I love having you on. We always have such interesting conversations. And until then, let's all stay in the flow of creativity.